Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. I am now your board rep this morning. So if you'd like to speak with me after the service, you can refer to me as Al, not as Blake. So I'm Al Haskell. I'm your board representative this morning. And pleased that you're all here. We have a variety of announcements about church life and activities. Please take a look at some of those announcements in the order of service, and also please take that order of service home with you because it really is captivating reading. There are, in addition, a few other items I'd like to bring to your attention. This is our 15th year as the Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church, starting from the minds of four and what you have here today. So we're celebrating that year, and we invite you to share with us a fond memory. So whether you're in church age 15 years old or one, you can write or draw it on a paper that's set up like a football field in our social hall. You'll notice that there are yard lines marked with 15. Apparently there are cookies to munch on while you ponder what fabulous memory it is that you'd like to share. I've yet to see the story of the change in the top of the church put in words. I'm just throwing that out to some individuals. There is a public forum in your order of service. You'll find this item. Please take this home. Please also help us promote and share this in your local communities. There will be our first orientation class of the year held on October 28th. There is a sign-up sheet out in the foyer, and you can certainly talk to myself or others on the membership committee. Chris White should be in the room. Wave your hand, Chris. Thank you. Isabel, could you come on up here for a second? Aren't you supposed to talk about this? That's what your mom said. Really? But, yeah, now you're the board rep. I'll help you. Okay, so you can get in there. So, what's that?
LCUUC's annual Time, Talent, and Treasures silent auction is quickly approaching. It starts next Sunday. For this event, members and friends donate their time, talent, and or treasures. Then, over the course of the next four Sundays in October, everyone has the opportunity to bid on these donated items. Last year, this event made over $6,000 for our church. Donation forms can be found in the social hall on the long counter above the recycling bins, or you can pick them up as you leave church today. There's a stack of them on the table by the doors for your convenience. Please see the flyer in your order of service for all the dates and details. Note that there is helpful information on both sides of the flyer.
Thank you. Also, a reminder that the deadline to sign up for the LCUUC Adult Enrichment Class, The Spirituality of Place in Art, is next Sunday, the 30th. The class is going to run for five consecutive Wednesday evenings here at the church. It's this Sunday. Huh. I'd like to apologize to those of you visiting that have not met me before. Janica Yoder, that's what I'm told to do, point her out, will be in the social hall after the service to answer your questions. All right. Would you please greet each other? Greetings. Greetings. Thank you. If you will please continue to greet each other after the service in the social hall. If you're visiting with us today, we particularly welcome you. There is a guest ledger on the visitor's table in the foyer. There is a variety of information out there that we'd be pleased for you to pick up and peruse. I'll be in the social hall after the service. Very pleased to talk with you and share with you what I can in perhaps my disjointed manner this morning, although it shouldn't be too bad. If you're visiting with your children today, we have... It's the custom of ours to have the children stay in the service, and then they will exit at a certain time to go out to their classes. If you're uncomfortable letting them go, they can stay with you, and that's just fine as well. Now, we always enjoy getting to know our guests, so if you've brought yourself and you feel like a guest, or if you've brought a guest, or if you're a guest who's come by yourself, this would be a great time to smile and say hello. Welcome. So everyone's invited to gather in the social hall after the service. There will be refreshments there and good conversation, so join us for that. Last announcement I'm told is to put your phones on silence mode. And after this long-winded, hopefully somewhat entertaining, hopefully somewhat instructional introduction, I hope you'll find this morning service inspiring, stimulating, fulfilling, and certainly worthwhile. Our speaker today has been with us before. We always enjoy having him with us. As you may have guessed with my lack of preparation, finding out I was board rep 3 minutes ago, I really don't know what he's going to talk about, and it's probably good based upon the skill of my introduction. So, all right, thank you.
Please join me in centering our souls in your order of service. I ask that you read the bold. In our lives, we long for peace, hoping and praying for the world to change.
The change begins with us. We create the possibility for peace by being peaceful.
Mahatma Gandhi said, "The means may be likened to a seed. the end to a tree, and there is just the same inviolable connection between means and the end as there is between the seed and the tree.
And we plant the seeds of peace, justice, kindness, and compassion, living them out in our lives and relationships. We help grow the tree of harmonious life.
Let us do away with all things violent. Violence can be physical, emotional, spiritual, economic, political, penal, sexual, verbal, racial, theological, environmental, militaristic, and social.
Violence infiltrates our lives and the structures of our society, so we must be vigilant in promoting nonviolence.
Constantly reminding ourselves of how not to be violent will never be successful, for violence is too pervasive.
We need to cultivate our spirits, our values, our virtues, our characters, our whole beings, so that we may instinctively act out of peaceful, gentle, and respectful ways in every situation. This is how peace begins.
Now I ask that you join in our chalice lighting response, also singing our chalice lighting response, also in your order of service. Please join us, stand and join us in our opening hymn, number 100. We now like to invite the young and the young at heart to come to the front for the story of all ages. And I believe we have Terry here today to do our story.
It's my first time. So today we're going to do a Yiddish folk tale, and this is kind of in keeping with the Jewish New Year being last week, and the middle school group came to our synagogue for one of the high holiday services. So I thought this would be a good story today. And it's called It Could Always Be Worse. And the pictures are so great if anybody wants to move up and see them. The illustrations are great. Once upon a time in a small village, a poor man lived with his mother, his wife, and his six children in a little one-room hut. All those people in one room. Because they were so crowded, the man and the wife often argued. The children were noisy and they fought. And in the winter, it was especially hard because everyone was stuck in that one room. The hut was full of crying and quarreling. One day when the poor, unfortunate man couldn't stand it anymore, he ran to the rabbi, which is like your minister, for help. "Holy rabbi, things are in a bad way with me and getting worse. We are so poor that my mother, my wife, and six children and I all live in one small hut. We are so crowded. There's so much noise. Help me, rabbi. I'll do whatever you say." The rabbi thought, and he pulled on his beard, and he said, "Tell me, my poor man, do you have any animals, perhaps a chicken or two?" "Yes, I do have a few chickens, also a rooster and a goose." "Ah, fine," said the rabbi. "Now go home and take the chickens, the rooster, and the goose into your hut to live with you." "Yes, indeed, rabbi," the man thought, and he was a little surprised. The poor man hurried home and took the chickens, the rooster, and the goose out of the shed and into his little hut. When some days had passed, life in the hut was worse than before. Now there was quarreling and crying, and also honking and crowing and clucking. And there were feathers in the soup. The hut stayed just as small, and the children were growing bigger. The poor man couldn't stand it anymore, and again he ran to the rabbi for help. "Rabbi, what misfortune has befallen me? Now with the crying and the quarreling, we have honking and clucking and crowing, and there are feathers in the soup. Rabbi, it couldn't be worse. Help me, please." The rabbi listened, and he thought, and he said, "Tell me, do you have a goat?" "Yes, I do have an old goat, but he's not worth very much." "Excellent," the rabbi said. "Now go home and take the goat into your hut to live with you." "Oh, no," said the man. "Do you really mean it? Come now, good man, and do as I say." "At once," the rabbi told him. The poor man trampled back to the hut with his head hanging down and took the old goat into his hut. You have to turn the page, even though I didn't. There he is taking the hut. Okay. Now we turn again. Had gone by. Life in the hut was much worse, as you can imagine, with the crying and the quarreling and the clucking and the honking and the crowing. The goat went wild. He was pushing and butting everyone with his horns. The hut seemed smaller. The children grew bigger. When the poor man couldn't stand it another minute, he ran to the rabbi. "Oh, rabbi, help me. Now the goat is running wild. My life is a nightmare." The rabbi listened, and he thought, and what do you think he said? "Do you have a cow?" Young or old, it doesn't matter. Yes, Rabbi, it's true I have a cow, the poor man said fearfully. Then go home and take the cow into your hut. Oh, no, surely not, Rabbi. Do it at once, the rabbi said. The poor man trudged home with a heavy heart and took the cow into his hut. Is the rabbi crazy? He thought. When some days had passed, life in the hut was worse than ever. Everyone quarreled. The chickens were quarreling with each other. The goat ran wild. The cow trampled everything. The man could hardly believe his misfortune. At last, when he could stand it no longer, he ran to the rabbi for help. Rabbi, help me, save me. The end of the world has come. The cow is trampling everything. There is no room even to breathe. It's worse than a nightmare. The rabbi listened and thought. At last he said, go home now, my poor man, and let the animals out of your hut. I will. I'll do it right away. The poor man hurried home and let the cow, the goat, the chickens, the goose, and the rooster out of the little hut. That night, the poor man, look at this, and his family slept peacefully. There was no crowing, no clucking, no honking, no trampling, no headbutting. There was plenty of room to breathe. The next day, the poor man ran back to the rabbi. Rabbi, you have made life sweet for me. With just my family in the hut, it's so quiet, so roomy, so peaceful. What a pleasure. Okay.
This is a time in our service where we invite you to share your joys and concerns. If you do have something you'd like to share, please raise your hand and an usher will bring a microphone to you. State your name and your joy or concern, and I will light a candle to commemorate. And I will start by lighting the first candle in hopes that we can all strive to have peaceful resolutions to many of the conflicts that happen even in our daily lives.
Terry. Hi, I'm Terry. So I have a joy that and a concern. The joy is that we have this wonderful foster dog, Springer Spaniel, and she is a delight to us, and we've had her all summer, and my concern is that she needs a home because she can't stay with us forever. We are foster parents, not forever parents. So this worked once before, and if anybody knows anyone who's looking for a dog, she's completely spayed, up to date on her shots, etc., and she's a wonderful girl. You can see me after. I'm going to teach class now.
My name is Chris. A candle of joy for our member, friend, Laura Levenhagen, who's winging her way to Bali this morning for 3 weeks of training and work in her field of cranial sacral therapy.
Hi, I'm John, a candle of joy for our son Joel, who recently became engaged to be married.
Hi, I was here last week and I talked about how some of my children are apart and at odds with each other, and one of my children got hurt this week and her sister came to help her. So that was a good thing.
Hi, I'm Kathy. I have a joy, and it is that it is autumn. I had such a beautiful drive to church this morning with all the colors, so I think we all have that definitely to be thankful and joyful about.
Hi, I'm Chris. We're new in our membership here. And I have a joy and a concern. My son Kai turns 6 tomorrow, and he's probably the shortest kid that was up there. He had a rough start in life, and every birthday, while it's a milestone, is also kind of a concern because he had a rough start, and it's a serves as a reminder that he's got a long way to go yet, so that's mine.
Hi, I'm Barb, and I have a candle of joy. I crossed the line of 60 years this week, and I'm so glad to be here with all of you and having this wonderful start to the rest of my life.
I am Al. My joy is next to me. And my hope is that she's successful in her application for her Fulbright scholarship.
Please join us in just a moment of brief meditation. Please remain seated and join us in our centering hymn number 166. This is a reading from Thomas Weber and Robert J. Burroughs in Nonviolence, an Introduction. Satyagraha, Gandhi explained, is literally holding on to truth and its means, therefore truth force, truth soul or spirit. It is therefore known as soul force. The technique of nonviolent struggle that Gandhi evolved in South Africa to gain rights for Indians was originally described by the English phrase passive resistance. Gandhi, however, felt that the term was too narrowly constructed, that it was supposed to be a weapon of the weak, and it would be characterized by hatred, and that it could manifest itself as violence. These attributes were not applicable to this method of direct action, and so he coined a new word, sat, meaning truth, and agraha, firmness. Satyagraha implies working steadily towards a discovery of truth and converting the opponent into a friend in the process. In other words, it is not used against anybody, but it is done with somebody. It is based on the idea that the moral appeal of the heart or conscience is more effective than an appeal based on threat or bodily pain or violence. And for Gandhi, it had to be a creed, a way of life, to be truly effective. The Satyagraha keeps the following propositions in mind. And there are 17 of them. 1. The aim in group struggle is to act in a way conducive to long-term, universal, maximal reduction of violence. 2. The character of the means used determines the character of the results. 3. A constructive program, positive peace-building work, should be a part of every campaign. 3. One should engage in positive struggle in favor of human beings and certain values, that is, fight antagonisms, not antagonists. 5. All human beings have long-term interests in common. 6. Violence is invited from opponents if they are humiliated or provoked. 7. A violent attitude on the part of would-be satyagrahis is less likely if they have made clear to themselves the essential elements of their case and the purpose of the struggle. 8. The better opponents understand the satyagrahis' position and conduct, the less likely they are to resort to violence. Secrecy should therefore be avoided. 9. The essential interests which opponents have in common should be clearly formulated and cooperation established on that basis. 10. Personal contact with the opponent should be sought. 11. Opponents should not be judged harder than the self. 12. Opponents should be trusted. 13. The property of opponents should not be destroyed. 14. An unwillingness to compromise on non-essentials decreases the likelihood of converting the opponent. 15. The conversation of an opponent is furthered by personal sincerity. 16. The best way to convince an opponent of your sincerity is to make sacrifices for the cause. And 17. A position of weakness in an opponent should not be exploited. Satyagrahi is concerned with morality over and above winning. How is one to decide which of two opposing cases is nearer the truth? According to Gandhi, the voice of conscience must be obeyed in these circumstances. Of course, this may present further problems. What one person sees as truth may just as clearly be untruth to another. For this reason, Gandhi warns, no one has the right to coerce others to act accordingly to his own view of truth. Therefore, nonviolence is the only appropriate means for arriving at truth. If the position held by the satyagrahi provides to be further from the truth than that of the opponent, it will only be the satyagrahi who suffers. Others will not be made to suffer for the satyagrahi's mistake.
Do you have all those 17 memorized now? We should learn from those who have gone before us, and so I want to preface what I'm saying today with you that nothing I'm saying is new. Most likely, at least I hope, that everything I'm about to say would be something that would be proposed and agreed to by people like Gandhi, as well as Martin Luther King Jr. and other proponents of nonviolence. So the way that I organize it might be a little different. The kind of language that I use to express my ideas might be a little bit different, but I don't think anything actually is new. Thinking about those who have done things before you, I put that a little bit more to today as well, and I hope that, like Al, I can have a little self-deprecating humor. And reminding myself of the story that we heard for the story of all ages, I just want to remind you as well that it could always be worse. So remember that as I get done with my speaking today. So. One of the things that we have noticed about nonviolence is that it usually gets put in the news when something has happened either internationally or within our nation as well. We know that there's a movement now called the Occupy movement in many nations, in which is talking about, you know, the 99% versus the 1% wealthiest people and such. And one of the things that they're proposing is that we act always with nonviolence. Nonviolence, whether it be with Gandhi or Martin Luther King, there are certain proponents and, or certain things that you need to do. You need to not take action physically or forcibly with anybody who would be your opponent. There's a lot of things in which we kind of probably just know instinctively and in hearing the news that you don't do this. If you're nonviolent, you do this. I'm not going to talk necessarily about the international and national kinds of nonviolence because I think really nonviolence starts with us. It starts with the individual. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about nonviolence in daily life. One of the things that was very important both to Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. is that we need to see this not as simply a tactic that we use to try to get our way about something. It's also not even to be necessarily used in strategic ways or pragmatic or practical ways. It really starts out when you accept it within your heart and soul, your mind, your whole being. It really is for both of those persons, and I think what I want to stress today is it is a spiritual way of being in the world. And by spiritual, I mean that the means and the ends must coordinate. That being good is valued more in this life by you than being successful, wealthy, prestigious, any other thing that you can think of. Have I got your attention? You see, this is something that affects everything that we do. There is nothing in life that doesn't involve this approach to life. From your family relationships, to your friends, to your coworkers, to schoolmates, to the stranger on the street, to people in other countries who you think are violent, to the person, maybe your next door neighbor that you think is violent. It applies to every aspect of our lives. And so it really is a spiritual, or as Gandhi considered, a religious response to life, that being a nonviolent person requires that we view life in a different way. We need to see others as equal to ourselves in their worth. And hopefully we see ourselves as worthwhile as well. Doesn't much help to see somebody as a horrible person because we see ourselves as a horrible person. So there has to be that presumption that we're all worthy in and of ourselves, and that worth is equal. It also is very egalitarian. So not only do we see the equality of worth between ourselves and others, but that we also need to treat each other in similar ways. It is egalitarian in the sense that the distribution of resources, of goods, is to be done as each has need. That the possession of rights is equal for everyone. Now, this is where it gets really tough. This is where you're going to think, well, maybe things can get worse. The thing about, and this, by the way, is something that a lot of the religious spiritual leaders throughout time, Buddha, Jesus, others, believed as well, is that we are to distribute everything as each has need. Not more, not wanting and gaining more than we really need, and also making sure that those who don't have enough, make sure that we share with them. It is egalitarian to the very core, nonviolence is. And why that is necessary to keep that kind of attitude is, as soon as we start thinking, well, we need to have more than enough, or we need to have more than somebody else, it becomes a competitive model. And as soon as it becomes competitive, then we're in it to win over others, which divides us from each other. That's the basic essence of what Gandhi and Martin Luther King, we're to be collaborative and cooperative with one another and see that our gain and your gain is all the same. That when you gain, I gain. When I gain, you gain. That it's not a competition with us. Part of the worldview of nonviolence requires that we affirm the universal human rights and maybe even the rights of other species and other things as well throughout the earth. Environmentalists would say, yes, we need to include all those other things as well, that maybe even non-living things. I know I've been on a lot of hikes. I'm an environmentalist myself, and I love nature and going out on hikes, especially when the leaves are just beautiful like they are right now. And so one of the things that sometimes I'll notice is litter along, and I think that's not really respectful for creation, nor the people who are going to see that. Writing on rocks, graffiti, and things like that, that's disrespectful. Maybe you're not hurting the rock itself, but you are disrespecting at least the beauty of nature. So a respect and a sense of universal human rights and rights of other things as well is necessary. To regard others as siblings or as yourself. Now, this sounds like a very religious sort of thing. Jesus, we know, as well as Buddha, believed these sorts of ideas that we need to treat others as we would be treated. The golden rule is true of all the world's religions. But sometimes we just kind of hear that and say, well, yeah, that's a nice way to think. But sometimes it's not practical. Sometimes it's not useful to do that. And so I will kind of cast it aside when it's not to my advantage to do so. They would say, and this is probably especially for progressive religious people who have trouble with absolutes of any kind, this is absolute. We need to be this way absolutely in every case. If we're not, it's going to fail without us being able to really make a dent, as well as not even being able to make a dent on our own spiritual lives. It is non-competitive, it's collaborative, it's cooperative, it is about relationship building and peace promoting. This is the worldview that we need to have if we're going to be able to withstand the rigors of nonviolent living. If you're not up for that kind of a worldview of looking at the world that way, it's not going to work for you. That's what Gandhi and Martin Luther King believed sincerely. So one of the first things that they tried to do is help people understand what it is to have a view of nonviolence. That it's not just a tactic. It is a way of spiritually being in the world. A lot of people, I remember the quote people like Malcolm X, who said, well, as long as it delays, nonviolence is fine as long as it gets the means, as long as we allowed to be free as black people. I think Malcolm X and a lot of other critics of nonviolence say it's not always practical. Of course, Gandhi and Martin Luther King would argue, say, well, yes, it is very practical. The thing is, it takes a long time. It's not going to happen overnight. You can't convince others of it overnight, and even if you get an entire society to be nonviolent, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to convert the rest of the world either. If you're, and this is the spiritual part of it, if you're going to be nonviolent, you have to be willing to adhere to it even if you are never successful. It has to be done for its own sake. Nonviolence is a good in and of itself, and to do anything else for any other reason, pragmatic or practicality, it means you have given up on nonviolence. So it is kind of a either-or absolutistic view of life. You adopt this life, and you have to do it wholeheartedly, or else it's doomed to fail. We become a little uncomfortable with any kind of absolutes. But this is one absolute in which both Gandhi and Martin Luther King believed you have to have. If you don't have the resolve and the commitment to do this, it's going to be unsuccessful. Not only in what you're hoping to accomplish, but it's also going to be unsuccessful in yourself. I can say myself, I've been trying to be an advocate and proponent of nonviolence all my life. And pretty much without fail, as soon as I come to talk about something like this, I will find stressors and things just popping up in my life and which make me challenge everything that I think. I was talking with a woman the other day in which it's nice to have friends who have a different perspective than you. It keeps the dialogue going, or at least hopefully keeps the dialogue going. But she was pretty much on the opposite side of the spectrum on everything imaginable. And we had a conversation in which we were talking about she was a creationist. She believed that the earth is only 1,000 years old, didn't believe in evolution. She didn't, you know, is all this just kind of fundamentalist kind of theology, which really kind of eats at my my very being. And I was finding it difficult to remain in dialogue and conversation with her because I was thinking, this is ridiculous. And I had to catch myself to try to not be, at least in my disposition, obviously not physically violent, but in my thoughts, to not be violent. It is a very rigorous and difficult philosophy, way of life to be in, because you are going to get challenged on it every day. Your crying kid, the neighbor next door who mows at on Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock in the morning, all these sorts of things can kind of get under your skin. But nonviolence, if taken seriously, does apply to all those things. The next part is not just the worldview itself, recognizing that it is a spirituality rather than just a tactic. But here are some of the responsibilities that you have. And it's important that since it is a spirituality, that the most important thing is to get away from the kind of rule mentality and that you've got to abide by these specific actions and rules in order to be nonviolent. And fact of the matter, if you try that, it's probably going to be self-defeating. Because just like there were 17 principles of Gandhi, to try to remember them all, and to try to, you know, by sheer willpower just to do them, it's going to be a failure. You can't remember, you know, 100. I listed actually for a communication workshop that I do that's kind of on nonviolence as well. I listed as many different kinds of violence as I could imagine. And I took many hours one day just to try to write every single one that I could think of down. I came up to a list just under 200 kinds of violence. I'm not going to list them all for you today. 200 kinds of violence? Really? I could, probably if I had more time, I could have thought some more. Violence is pervasive in our lives. Coercion, manipulation, any way in which you try to get an advantage over other is a form of violence because it's non-cooperation. With another person. It's trying to put your interests versus their interests rather than seeing your interests collectively as one. King and Gandhi both said, if you do anything to another, it affects you as well, and it affects everyone else. It's kind of the ripple effect. Whatever you do is going to have a ripple effect on the entire community. So the first thing that you need to do, rather than being rule-based or principle-based, is cultivate virtues. Virtues are kind of dispositions or character traits that involve everything. So if you become a kind, compassionate, considerate, loving, patient person, if you cultivate virtues like that, then there, whatever happens to you in your life, if that's the way that you respond and react to life and that you habituate those things in your life, then you're naturally going to respond in those ways. So you don't have to remember the rules or the principles. It becomes a part of who you are. Cultivate virtues rather than rules or principles, and this makes your actions habitual. It makes them instinctive rather than simply a matter of willpower. I don't know how many of you have problems with willpower, but I'm one who does. If you put chocolate in front of me, I will eat it. Case closed. I can say, oh, I want to lose weight. I see that piece of chocolate. I'm going to eat it. Willpower becomes nothing with chocolate with me. I don't know if you have your own things in which willpower is tough. But certainly when things become unpragmatic for you, when you see that they might be detrimental for you to do a particular thing, most of us say, no, really don't want to do that. I'm going to try to avoid that. The thing about nonviolence is sometimes it is very unpragmatic. We know that Gandhi, as well as Martin Luther King, lost their life for their cause. People oppose them. It seems just bizarre to us that somebody who promotes peace and love among everyone would be killed out of hatred. It seems bizarre, doesn't it? But the fact is, it will happen because they were proposing a totally different way of life, a lifestyle that is so antithetical to everything that we know as cultures. They were undermining the very structures of society and the values that we each sometimes hold so dear. I ask you just to think about one particular ambition that we in the United States especially hold dear, and especially after we had the Olympic Games, or we didn't have them, but England had them. But, you know, we're all rooting for our teams and our individual Olympians and such like that. And I actually love the Olympics. I watch them all the time. I promote the Olympics myself. But I also recognize there's kind of an underlying thing that works against nonviolence here, and that is competition itself. You have one winner, okay, maybe three total if you count the bronze and the silver medals as well. But you basically have one winner, and everybody else is a loser. It's kind of a winner takes all. One person is the best, and everybody else is less than best. Whereas what King and Gandhi were trying to get is to look at us in a way to where we see our relationships with one another as not something in which I'm better than you or you better than me, but that we cooperate to mutual ends together. We all become winners. That success is not about how much we make, it's about how well we get along with one another. So it is a whole different way of looking at life that sometimes is not going to be to our benefit. And so because of that, we need to put, instead of things like wealth and prosperity and success as the things that are our goals in life, we need to desire other things more than those. Things like justice. Things like reconciliation. Justice is hard because we see that there's too much injustice in the world. And sometimes it seems so big that there's nothing that we can do. And quite honestly, when I think about the things that I would like to see justice in the world, I think, me, how am I going to stop all that? But we do it bit by bit, person by person. When we see an injustice in our own lives or somebody in our work relationships or at school, we need to be the person who advocates for justice in that situation. It takes little bitty instances of justice to finally have an impact that becomes a much bigger cultural kind of justice. The other thing, reconciliation. Sometimes we don't actually want to be reconciled with people. Think of the people that are in prison for heinous crimes that they've done. Do you really, in your heart of hearts, want to be reconciled to those people? Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. would say, this is what we need to create in our entire culture. That yes, we need to have reconciliation. There may need to be rehabilitation rather than vengeance against them. We need to change the penal system and the structures of how we inculcate people who are offenders, violent offenders in our society. But that needs to be our ambition. That needs to be the thing that we do, is reconcile everyone together with one another. Gandhi had his doubts about this. King kind of had a Christian view that, you know, we're finally going to prevail. Gandhi had a little bit more pessimism in this regard and said, well, we have to keep practicing even if it may never prevail. And I'm with him on that. I'm probably a little bit more like Gandhi than King, and I'm not so sure that it'll ever happen. But if it never happens at all, I will not think that my life trying to be a nonviolent person has been not worthwhile. Because again, success is not measured by the outcomes. Success is measured by whether I am a person of integrity who upholds these values and these virtues in my life. That in itself, we talk a lot about self-esteem in this culture, and a lot of self-esteem has to do with what we achieve, what outcomes that we get. This is a way of thinking which says outcomes matter not so much. It's not that we don't want good outcomes to happen. A nonviolent person would never say that. But that it is a secondary or even tertiary concern. That the real concern of being nonviolent is to be nonviolent for its own sake, because it is a good in itself. So to be virtuous and cultivate the virtues of nonviolence, that is what we're to be about in our lives. If we cultivate these virtues in our life, work on it each and every day, we will eventually habituate those things in our lives, where it'll be easier for us to step up for justice and and for reconciliation with others. I don't know if any of you have seen a program on TV. I don't watch a whole lot of TV myself, but somebody told me about this program, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. It's What Would You Do? Anybody seen or heard of that one? It puts instances in which somebody's put in a position in which seems like it's unjust or not right in some way, and then whether people will actually speak up and say something. From what I've gathered from the times that I have watched the program, most people don't. They just kind of, you know, keep on walking by and try to avoid the situation, not to do anything. A few people, though, will kind of, you know, have that fire and spark in them, and they will say, look, this is wrong. This, you know, you can't do this. The more that we practice that second kind of way, the more what we do that daily in our lives, the more that it will become easy for us to do that, to stand up for what is right against that which we know, which everybody would agree is wrong. A big part of nonviolence is actually the commitment itself of a lifestyle of nonviolence, that you live by nonviolence come what may. Now, one of the most difficult, I think I'll speak personally for myself, is that I have fears in my life. Do you? There are fears that I have about, well, if I do this, how's it going to affect me financially? I have fears that if I do this, that it may get me in some other kind of trouble. That my relationship, if I don't concede and I'm not allowing myself to be manipulated by somebody else who wants, you know, a certain kind of control, that they may become antagonistic towards me. I like it. I'm somewhat of a people pleaser. And so, to commit yourself to this, to put away fears, that is a big part of what nonviolence is. Can you imagine Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi as they were going in waves in the marches that they did, knowing that they are going to be beaten and also imprisoned, and yet they kept on walking. That's kind of the evidence of that. But a lot of things sometimes are the fears of not being popular, especially in school. I remember when I was in school, popularity was an important thing. You want to do all the right things that the cool kids do. And then later in life, you want to make sure that in the workplace that you do the things that the boss is going to respect. Sometimes you got to do the right thing even if it's not what the boss wants or what the cool kids do. You just need to do the right thing. And that's part of the commitment to nonviolence. Another part of nonviolence that is your responsibility is to cultivate respect for all life. Even all things, not just all humans. We can do this by cultivating the virtue of respectfulness in ourselves. When we become, generally, it's just our demeanor to be respectful towards all that we consider and view in life. When you see that that's the object, then when we see or identify ourselves as not being respectful at any time, then we kind of catch ourselves and say, oh, that's not really in accordance with the virtue that I'm wanting to have. I don't have to remember all the rules that I can and I can't do that so that I avoid those legalisms as well. I just remember, is this a respectful way of being in the world? Respect for all life is important. Gandhi and King, by the way, believe that you need to actually admit that you could be wrong and that your enemy could be right. Now, both of those were strong-minded individuals who believed that they were right. I have to say I'm one of those myself. But the willingness to admit that you may be wrong puts you in a different relationship to that person, where you're more willing to listen and understand the other person's point of view without judging them. That was really helpful this week with that woman that I was talking about earlier. I had to remember that myself. Part of nonviolence, too, our responsibility is to never use weapons or use of force, whether in work or in play or in life in general. Now, play is where we probably most often fail. Have any of you seen some of those video games and stuff in which, you know, just killed him? I have to admit that at different times in my life, I've played some of those games and actually enjoyed them. I don't anymore, simply because that's part of my discipline to nonviolence. Trying to get violence out of my life as much as possible, even in play. There have been some psychological studies done on children who were given games in which were nonviolent to play and those who were given games that were violent to play. Directly after they were asked to engage in a group, their own group, in which they were to be cooperating on some project, it found that those who were playing the nonviolent games were much more cooperative and willing to get along and collaborate with one another than those who were playing the violent games. Sounds like good sense? So there have been actually studies done on this. So the more that we invite violence of any kind, even in play in our life, the more that it will become part of our life. And the more that we disregard it, the more that it will not. To reject coercion and manipulation, intimidation, and other methods that seek to gain power and influence over others is another thing, a part of nonviolence. There is a list of things that we really need to refuse to do, and I'm going to read this very quickly because I don't want to go on each point. But there's these kind of violences that I would have you to think about. Physical violence, including things like the use of weapons, force, intimidation, pushing, shoving, fighting, or militarism. Emotional violence or verbal violence, or things like gossip, slander, lying, put-downs, condescension, insults, derision, ignoring others, ostracizing others. Financial violence are things like unfair business practices, advantages gained over others to make unlevel playing field, cheating, individually or corporately, stealing, also individually or corporately, Disparity of incomes. Anyone working full-time and yet not making enough to pay necessary bills, that's a kind of financial violence. The minimum wage where it is at $7.25 an hour, that is financial violence. Cultural violence. Things like, I'm going to get in trouble here. Patriotism. Nationalism. Unfair trade and labor practices. Unjust laws. Taxing the poor at the same or greater rate than the wealthy. All these things are forms of cultural violence. Political and spiritual violence would include things like inciting fear to garner cooperation with or agreement with one. Threatening or ostracization to induce conformity on non-essentials. Stifling debate and freedom of speech. Imprisonment for non-violent civil disobedience. Fines for public free expression. All those things would be political violence. So you see, and these are just a few examples, there's a lot of different kinds of violence in our life. We need to reject all these forms. Getting down to the latter parts, but this is probably the most important of all, that of the virtues that you need to have, the one that I would say, and I think King and Gandhi would agree with me on this, the most important one to make as the virtue, the priority, even the purpose for your life, is compassion. The word compassion, by the way, it certainly involves things like helping those in need. It means that we need to empathize and sympathize and respect people with other viewpoints. But there's a few things other that come with compassion. That is, forgive others when they've done you or somebody else wrong. Forgiveness is a hard thing. And we don't forgive because they deserve it. We forgive because we need to forgive in order to remain nonviolent and to remain loving ourselves. It's not about them, it's about us and the way that we choose to live our lives. So forgiveness. Compassion, I was about to say, literally means with suffering. So then when you have compassion with somebody, you are willing to engage in their suffering. So it means that you are willing to inflict suffering upon yourself on the behalf of somebody else for a greater cause or principle. Compassion with suffering. Are you willing to suffer for the sake of doing what is right? That is maybe one of the harder things for us to think about. One of the things that I believe that both Gandhi and King would believe are these little vignettes, that gentleness is valued over ambition. We're a very ambitious society, aren't we? If we think gentleness is actually the virtue that we really ought to be thinking rather than our ambition to get ahead or be number one, wouldn't it change our society? That kindness is to be valued over success. That peace is to be valued over victory. That love is to be valued over power. That trust is to be valued over fear. When one of the 17 things is that we need Gandhi had said, one of them was to trust others. And most of us think, now, wait a minute. Doesn't that put me in a very vulnerable position, especially when the person is untrustworthy? How many of us know untrustworthy people in our lives? I can say I know quite a few of them. And this is a very difficult one for me because as soon as I trust them, well, aren't I just making myself a fool? Gandhi and King both believed that if you trust others, one, it allows them to see that you're trying to be a friend with them. Second thing it does is it makes them want to be a person who is respect worthy of your trust. And the third thing it does, and they really didn't say this, I'm adding this myself, is that it allows them to see that they're a person who should be trusted. I don't know if you've ever had somebody who, when you've made some kind of real boo-boo in life, has tried to encourage you and say something to, you know, even though they knew that you did wrong, that they still try to say, this is what you should have done in this circumstance. They try to encourage you to be the best person, that they trusted in the implicit goodness in you despite what they saw. That's what we need to do with others. Trust them in that way. And the last thing is to never give up on nonviolence. To strive to live the most virtuous and good life possible, even if it fails. Because there is no real failure in living a nonviolent lifestyle. So if there's one thing in which we all need to practice on, if we're to be proponents of nonviolence, is that day by day, we need to practice cultivating and habituating the virtues that make for nonviolence until they come naturally and effortlessly in our life. Practice makes perfect. Peace be with us. All right. I've given probably a lot of things to debate me about, a lot of things to think about. So whether you've got insights or questions or retaliations, bring them this way, hopefully nonviolently. Yes. Okay, a good point, because there's a lot of things in life in which can make, you know, bond us to one another. I think the question that I would have is, if you put yourself in the position of the person who's being gossiped about, how would you feel about the gossip being done? And if you would think that you would not like that, don't do it towards somebody else.
I felt compelled this week to write a letter to the editor in regards to the treatment of children who go to school as a Democrat, with their parents' views of a Democrat in this county, a lot of Republicans. And these kids are just bullied for their views. And my kids, as moderates, just keep their mouth shut and out of the way because they know what it's like to be bullied. But
right.
And my point was to the parents, it's like you're spouting all this nastiness and vitriol and carrying on about the other guy.
Right.
And it makes the kids think that it's okay to do that and to put down other people who don't believe in what you believe in. And I made the point of how do we want to raise our kids? What do we want from them? Do we want them to be kind and loving and compassionate? You know, and everything you do and say in front of your kids, you got to think about. And I sent it off. And then the next day I thought, well, what about when I'm driving? And someone's not a very good driver around me. And, you know, and I'll spout off. And it actually made me think. So the letter, I don't know if it might just anger people, but it helped me to really look at myself after I wrote it, and I guess I just didn't see any of it until I wrote it down. what do I want my kids to come out being? How do I want them to treat others? You know, do I want them to be loving or hateful? And I saw all the things in a moment that I had said and done that were less than. Mm-hmm. And just in that moment, I changed how I behaved. And I hope the letter that I wrote to the editor, it comes out this week, that it will help other parents to think about that.
Right.
But it's a spot-on topic for me today, and I thank you.
Thank you. One of the things Gandhi and King both believed is that there's all kinds of reasons to be angry about things, about bullying and other things in which, you know, people are not showing respect for one another. And so it's okay to be angry. In fact, it's absolute necessity sometimes as far as social movements to show some righteous anger. But that the anger is to be directed towards the positions rather than the people. And so it's don't be angry at people, don't put down people, rather deal with the issues in which you disagree with. Yeah. Okay. Who's next? One more? Okay. So. Yeah.
And I've got the green light.
Okay.
I'm Yvonne. Actually, I have two things, so I'll keep them really short. One is, follows with what you just said. I heard on the radio this guy was honored for conflict resolution styles and how well he did. And the image that he presented was, if you have a conflict, instead of face-to-face with the person and try and work it out, was to sit side-by-side with the person, and the problem is across the table, so you both are bringing your perspectives to the problem, and you know, it allows the conflict to be outside of the two people, just an image that works. And I didn't hear too much about why we would choose this difficult road, just that the road is very difficult, and right. Besides having a gentler society, I think for me it would be that we have gentler, I would be a gentler person, and it's really involves asking my heart what would I do, what would I think, you have to engage your brain, but you can get stuck there. I think asking the heart how to respond is really so that you can live a happier, pleasant life.
Yeah, thank you. There's so much to talk about with regard to nonviolence. I had enough for about 40 sermons in my preparations, like, oh my gosh, how am I going to divide this? So I'm not going to talk about why you need to be violent or nonviolent or those sorts of things. I tried to get a little bit on the practical side, but I think just a quick response to that is that if you have to be convinced of why nonviolence is a good thing, you're probably never going to be nonviolent. If it's not already, that you don't see the kind of the intrinsic and inherent value of being nonviolent, it's going to be hard to convince anybody of that. So, in any case, another reason for cultivating the virtues of it and to display that in our lives. I thank you so much for listening. I know I've been long-winded today. Thank you for being nonviolent in that respect towards me. And if you want to talk more or ask questions of me or with each other, talk about it, please do that in the fellowship time together. Okay? So let us continue in our... Let's see where I'm at here. Our offertory. So... part of what our offerings go to is to create that justice and that sense of being a community of that we are all one. So give generously that we may create that kind of community. Please stand for our congregational affirmation, which is found on page 597 in our hymn books. Nonviolence didn't start with King or Gandhi, either one. Long before them, Hindus and other religious traditions saw the wisdom of nonviolence. This comes from the Dhammapada. Please read the italicized print, and I'll read the regular print. Never does hatred cease by hating in return. Victory breeds hatred. They who give up all thought of victory or defeat, let us overcome violence by gentleness. Let us overcome the miserly by liberality. Join with me in singing number 162, Gonna Lay Down My Sword and Shield.
Lay down my sword and shield, down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside, gonna lay down my sword and shield, down by the riverside. Leave you with these words of Mahatma Gandhi. By the way, Mahatma, does anybody know what that means? Great soul. Great soul. So that's all what we should strive to be, is Mahatmas, great souls. Said these words, nonviolence is not a garment to put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart, and it must be an inseparable part of our being. Let it be.